KSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
From Hamilton, Ontario, this is the Green Planet Monitor, your weekly report on Earth systems, human development, justice, and science. Today, Donald Trump wants Greenland and won't take no for an answer. Will Canada be next? And speaking out for justice in Palestine, watch out for your career. This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. First, news headlines from GPM contributor Kylie Wong.
At a time when every dollar counts, Canada's clean fuel rules are facing backlash over their impact on fuel prices. The Canadian Taxpayers Federation says people are still paying more for gas due to clean fuel regulations. The hidden carbon tax will add up to 7 cents per liter of gas this year, says Franco Terrazano, federal director of the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. As regulations kick in fully by 2030, they'll increase the price of gas by up to 17 cents per liter, Terrazano says. Despite relentless attacks from Alberta's United Conservative Party, unions continue to thrive in Canada's toughest labor climate. According to Alberta's Union Advantage, unionized workers earn 10% more on average than non-unionized workers, with especially large benefits for women, young workers, immigrants, and part-timers, and have better access to benefits. According to Andrew Stevens, University of Regina professor and Union Floor Research Scholar in Labor Relations, union density in Alberta has increased and membership has grown. In a major pivot after years of tension, Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney has met China's Xi Jinping in Beijing. Carney finalized an agreement permitting thousands of Chinese electric vehicles to enter the Canadian market in return for reduced duties on Canadian canola products. It's a landmark agreement, Carney said. It's a partnership that reflects the world as it is today, with an engagement that is realistic, respectful, and interest-based, Carney said in a news conference. According to Carney, he and Chinese President Xi Jinping found much alignment on Greenland sovereignty in response to U.S. President Donald Trump's threats to seize the frozen but fast-melting territory. Greenland should determine its own future, Carney says, and Canada is prepared to defend this right in line with Canada's obligation under Article 5 of the NATO Charter. In Mr. Carney's mind, however, not all people have the right to determine their own future. The Canadian Department of Foreign Affairs has hailed an agreement between the UK and the island nation of Mauritius, locking in UK-US control over a major military base from which hundreds of indigenous peoples were forcibly expelled. Mauritius gained its independence from Britain in 1968, but the UK and US held onto part of its territory, the Chagos Islands, in the central Indian Ocean. The largest of the Chagos Islands, Diego Garcia, is home to one of the most strategic US military installations in the world. Between 1967 and 1973, hundreds of Chagosians were forcibly expelled to make way for the base. In 2019, the International Court of Justice ruled Britain's administration of the Chagos Islands to be unlawful. Despite this, a 2025 deal between the UK and Mauritius, leasing Diego Garcia to the UK and US for 99 years, drew UN criticism for violating Chagosian rights. Canada supports this deal entirely. You can hear more about this in last week's edition of the GPM. That's it for today's news. Back to you, David.
Thanks, Kylie. Trump wants Greenland, he's repeatedly declared, and will get it one way or the other. Military force is a clear option. We won't get anything unless I use excessive strength and force, Trump told the packed room at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, yesterday. Trump's rationale for such an unprecedented move, in blatant violation of international law, not to mention the founding document of NATO, the North Atlantic Charter, protecting the Western Hemisphere from the rapacious Chinese and Russians, of course, neither Russia nor China threaten the semi-autonomous, entirely frozen island, a sovereign territory of the Kingdom of Denmark, the real reason for Trump's Greenland lust is clear. Borrowing a phrase from Bill Clinton, it's the precious minerals, stupid. Trump didn't abduct Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, effectively taking over the South American nation, because Maduro is a drug trafficker. Trump wanted Venezuelan oil. Likewise, it's the incredibly precious rare earth metals buried beneath Greenland rock that Trump thirsts for. If the U.S. does invade Greenland, guess who could be next? Canada. So says Robert Hewish, associate professor in international development studies at Dalhousie University. He's not the only one. Perhaps not immediately as the 51st state, Hewish writes in a recent article for The Conversation, but quite possibly as a U.S. territory that would deny Canadians any voting rights for Congress or the presidency. The GPM reached out to Robert Hewish. Hello, Robert Hewish. Welcome to the Green Planet Monitor.
Good to see you, David. Thanks so much.
Robert, is this just a kind of a fantastical fantasy idea that the United States could seize Canadian territory as Canadians and the rest of the world are watching Donald Trump and listening to him swearing, vowing that it's just a matter of time before he seizes Greenland? It's going to be either the easy way or the hard way, and he's going to do it come what may. And so Canadians are wondering, what's next? Is this just fantasy that Canada, Canadian territory could be seized? What would you say to them?
It's definitely Trump's fantasy. It's something that he's absolutely salivating for, I think, ever since Prime Minister Justin Trudeau visited him in Mar-a-Lago in the early days, just after his initial election. And the thing is the rhetoric that comes out of Trump should always be taken seriously, but it's difficult to unpack what is a combination of sort of his own delusional fantasies and what is capable of actually occurring through processes of the U.S. military or the U.S. government. So when he's going off about, you know, we're going to run Venezuela, we need to own or control Greenland, those terms of run and control, we can really unpack to see what that's like. Now, for Canada, he's given us, privileged status, if you would. I mean, far beyond the desires of Puerto Rico or the 12 other overseas U.S. territories to bring Canada straight in as statehood. Now, that, again, is the language being used, and we sort of say, okay, there is a desire. Now, what does that look like logistically? There's two big logistics involved with this. First, could it legally happen? Is there actually policy architecture on the American side, and then we could always discuss the Canadian side, to actually have that occur? And then the second question is, what would that look like on a day-to-day basis? And the scary answer for many Canadians is to hear is that it is constitutionally possible on the U.S. side to annex another country.
Tell me how that would work.
So we look back at the history of where the U.S. has annexed territories in the past. And again, it is an inherently expansionist country. Even the design of the flag is made for that. You can quickly take a Google search of what a star-spangled banner with 51 or 52, I think they've even got to go up to 58 stars if they wanted to. And it's something where within the process of that country, acquiring further territories is inherent to its raison d'etre. So the big one, of course, Louisiana Purchase, and then in 1848 with the Treaty of San Hidalgo, the purchasing of half of Mexico's territory, or through cession, I should say, at the end of the American-Mexican War, acquiring half of the territory there. Alaska was purchased. Hawaii came into the U.S. domain through a period of cession, and then there was occupation of several Pacific Island nations following World War II. So how it works is that in the U.S. Constitution, in the Article 2, Clause 2, is right there about how a president can propose treaties. So if the executive office is able to propose a treaty with another territory, present that with their signatures on board to say, we agree to this, then that treaty is then sent to the U.S. Congress. It needs to pass by more than two-thirds majority, both in the House and the Senate, and then, boom, under the eyes of the law of the U.S., that territory is now under American control. It's not an instant invitation to statehood. That's the second process. Usually the first step is to have a U.S. territory, and then that territory, through treaty, through agreement, then applies to become a full-blown state, which is what we saw with Hawaii there post-World War II.
And with the exception of the 13, with the exception of the 13 original colonies, which became states, all the other 50 states in the United States of America have been secured through cession, occupation, or annexation, purchase.
Yes, yes. So cession is exactly that. That's your annexation. That's acquiring that land, and that either occurs through agreement. So again, the U.S.-Mexico War, you had members of Congress at the time in the 1840s to say, take all of Mexico, take it all the way down to Guatemala. And then they sort of held back and said, well, that's going to get tricky if we try to take all that. So the agreement between the Mexican forces and the U.S. forces, even though the battling was mostly around Texas, was again to claim all the northern territories, right up to Oregon. So Texas all the way across to what is today the northern border of California. So that is the idea of cession. You have occupation, again, which we saw post-World War II in the Pacific. We see that there were territories occupied after the Spanish-American War, Cuba, Puerto Rico, Philippines, in that way. And then, of course, purchasing. Now, I believe the U.S. has purchased things from Denmark in the past, particularly the U.S. Virgin Islands. But today, purchasing land is just too expensive. Nobody can afford it. So it's either got to take place through military aggression or through some sort of an agreement. And what is particular about Trump and the MAGA crowd is that they're not big on long-term occupations. In particular, that comes out of sort of an anti-George Bush sentiment within the Republican Party, very well aware of the commitments that he made to put U.S. troops into Iraq, into Afghanistan, 20-year war, Taliban is still in charge. How many veterans are sleeping homeless in the U.S. every night? How many veterans get their disability denied? So there's a lot of grievance there about the consequences and very fresh memory about putting boots on the ground. But what Trump likes to do is two things. One, play with airplanes, and two, play with commandos. Get the Delta Force to come in there, remove a head of state, if you recognize it or not, Nicolas Maduro, and then kidnap him out, or to send strategic bombing campaigns into Iran. In both cases, boots really aren't on the ground more than they have to be. And this is now the new way of using that military force as opposed to traditional colonial occupation, but to take that regime and kind of hold them hostage. You'll do what we say or else.
And nor has the U.S. Congress been involved, obviously, in what essentially at this moment amounts to the United States takeover of Venezuela. I mean, yeah. For all intents and purposes, the United States has taken over Venezuela. It's tapping its oil. It's demanding fealty, which is being delivered, rendered up, and Congress has not approved of this at all. So one wonders if the United States were to make a move on Greenland, who knows exactly what they'd do, but if Trump were to declare in an executive order that Greenland is hereafter considered to be annexed, what's Congress going to do about it?
Well, that's all they could do is challenge him and deny funding for certain things. But once the military follows orders and executes them, then it's basically the ball's in motion. It's unlikely there'd be any sort of hostility during the winter months in Greenland because, believe it or not, Arctic ice is still a big deal to move a Navy and even an Air Force around. The winter logistics are very, very difficult. So I would say that this conversation is probably going to drag out until June. And the more easy way for Washington to get what they want, which would be control of Greenland, would be to recognize Greenland is a territory of Denmark, and then to start to create pushes and political incentives and foreign interference towards a referendum. Would Denmark entertain a referendum from Greenland? Would the 53,000 people who live permanently in Greenland vote in favor of separation from Danish control and entertain territorial position under the U.S.? There's been a lot of calls by the Danish government to say that the U.S. has been interfering and conducting foreign interference on Danish territory. And certainly Trump isn't beyond that, about trying to disregard those traditional rules of partnerships with Europe, partnerships with NATO, with the Five Eyes even, and say we're just going to go here and there. And I think what the real concern of this is that we're actually teetering on the edge of the end of a liberal rules-based order, where you have now two or three reckless players in the world who are disregarding the old way of doing things. And for smaller states who have sort of had that shadow protection that Canada's benefited from U.S. military superiority in the hemisphere, now we really got to rethink what our future is going to look like. It's not the first time in history when the U.S. has barked about territorial disputes, and even Trump says that, you know, the border between Canada and the U.S. is just arbitrary. It doesn't matter to him. He's not the first president to go along that line. But also, if we look back in the 1930s, there was, this is scary, the creation of occupation plans by the War Department. And again, no longer the Ministry of, no longer the Department of Defense, but war. And that War Department between World War I and World War II, they came up with War Plan Red, which was a plan to seek out and occupy British territories and countries loyal to Britain if England went fascist during the 1930s. And they had it all planned out. It was basically you start with a naval attack into Halifax, gas the place, then move the ships up into Montreal and Quebec and basically take over the St. Lawrence, take over the power productions in Niagara Falls, basically, and any sort of electrical generation in Ontario, and then secure British Columbia, and the middle would fall as it would. And that was exercised in 1930 and then reapproved by Congress in 1934 to continue that war game, that exercise still going.
Now, if the United States military, Pete Hegseth, completely loyal to Trump, if when temperatures warm and ice clears and U.S. military vessels sail into Nook Harbor in southern Greenland, or military forces are beefed up at Patufik Base, formerly Thule, in northern Greenland, and then they decide to take a next step and move westwards and seize a little pocket of Canadian territory. Is this something they would do?
Yes, and history shows us how that recipe has traditionally worked in the past. There's a lot of rhetoric that comes out of Washington, despite very clear imperialist tendencies over the last 250 years, where it's like, wow, we take nothing by force. We do it through cooperation or the right to be there. And how many cases can we point to in history when there's a show of force, particularly naval, that goes around a territory to be acquired, and then something blows up and goes bang, and that justifies the response for coming in? So we could start with the destruction of the Maine, the USS Maine, in Havana Harbor, which at the time when it exploded, it was said, oh, the Spanish clearly shelled this ship, and this is an act of aggression. So in comes Teddy Roosevelt and the Rough Riders, and despite the fact in 1898 you had now 3 years of war between Cuban independent forces and Spain, in come the U.S. cavalry, in come the Navy, they push Spain right to the very edge. And the Armistice Treaty is one that's signed between the U.S. and Spain. Cuba isn't even part of the equation. So you have that. You've got cases like in World War I, where, again, it took three more years for the U.S. to get involved, but Lusitania, that got people going. Pearl Harbor is another example there. You had the Gulf of Tonkin incident. You had also a similar attack on a U.S. ship that justified bombing of Cambodia in the mid-1970s. And then, of course, there was multiple attacks on vessels, U.S. vessels around the Persian Gulf that, again, gave that impetus that we need to have more military force in the Middle East in the early 2000s. So if there's a show of force and any sort of accident happens that could say that this is a terrorist act or a threat to security or any sort of misunderstanding, that begins that conversation about applying military force as the righteous thing to do. And again, that history really starts in 1898 in Havana Harbor.
And where would this most likely happen in Canada? Would it happen in some really remote location, like in northern in Nunavut or in northern Labrador, or could this happen somewhere along the U.S.-Canadian border?
I think the risk is there that if you've got a anywhere on the border, that if you've got a country with large military capacity and reckless leadership that is intimidating neighbors, insulting friends, and proposing annexation, any time that there are apparatus that could show force around sovereign territory, that increases the risk. So I would not encourage a whole lot of presence over the next while until this rhetoric boils down. Because it's things like that. It's the accidents in a risky tinderbox environment that then create the forest fire and things get out of control.
And I can imagine a situation where you're getting a lot of American citizens crossing the U.S.-Canadian border coming into Canada because they're really worried about what's going on in the United States. And there are protests going on, and suddenly the United States considers it to be within its right to make an incursion into Canadian territory to put down what it considers to be a threat against its own sovereignty.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if there was any sort of physical show of force of military or even non-military, it could be citizenry. It could be something like this where there's been security and strategies put up in the past. Like, what happens if you had a convoy of truckers that wanted to do a show of force right through the Canadian border checkpoint? What would we do? Right. There's a whole bunch of scenarios that can come into it. And the sharp fact is that we do not have enough counterforce to deter any sort of military aggression or militia aggression. If that was to occur, there'd be a response. There would be our police and our military would do something, but it wouldn't be enough to deter the possibility. So this is where that channel of diplomacy and dialogue needs to keep going, because if anything, if that it fails, then those tensions can get pretty high. And with Trump's logic, he's again a convicted felon who has lied his way into the White House twice now, basically running through a complete disrespect for jurisprudence, rule of law, and even humanity in terms of the response to the shooting in Minneapolis. The guy's got no morals. And when you have a character of that regard in that position of power, he might just try something to push something, right? That comes right out of Putin's playbook too, right? We'll just push the boundaries here and see if we get a response. And many of our allies in Europe right now are still very much like, we need agreements. We need appeasement. We cannot show force back to the U.S. I mean, at least in Canada, we took the liquor off the shelves for a while.
I'm not sure if you've read Gwyn Dyer's column that was just published yesterday or the day before, proposing that Canada consider joining the French, who've spoken about this, in introducing a military European presence in Greenland to ostensibly protect the United States and Donald Trump against what he claims to be a threat from China and Russia, and just step in and say, here we are, we're protecting us all from the evil Chinese and the Russians. And Gwyn Dyer is citing this. I gather Emmanuel Macron has floated this idea, and others, and Gwyn Dyer is suggesting that perhaps Canada should do the same and offer to send Canadian troops to Greenland, and then in return ask that European forces come to Canada and protect us against the United States. It all seems preposterous.
It is wild to be talking about this as a non-science fiction dialogue, to certainly. But he might have a key point in there that's sort of buried in the base, and that is when it comes to actually monitoring the Arctic and collecting intelligence through satellite or signal intelligence or even human intelligence to look at weird behaviors of going on above and below the ice, as Russia does frequently put through nuclear-powered ships and their submarines under the ice and the whole deal. We are in a position to monitor that much more efficiently than the U.S. military.
It's more, you're saying it's more easy to monitor the presence of Russian submarines under the ice than it is to monitor the presence of American submarines.
Not so much. What I mean is, if there's a shared interest between Canada and the U.S. about keeping Russia out of sovereign waters of North America, if it's Greenland, Canada, or the U.S., the Canadian military, Canadian Navy, can do it at a far more efficient and better means than the U.S. can, because a show of force, physical presence in the Arctic by the U.S. is expensive. Anytime you move around the U.S. military, I mean, it's one of the largest employers of people in the world, but it's also one of the most expensive things in the world to operate. And we can do it at a much cheaper and more efficient means. And that's actually one of the security advantages that Canada already brings to the U.S. is our ability to keep the second largest territorial landmass in the world, national landmass in the world, covered. We can survey things. And in terms of response, if it's joint coordinated or whatever the situation is, then that's something the U.S. would want to be actively involved with. But that physical presence of monitoring and keeping things under control, maybe there's something to say that NATO would want to have more of a presence there, so the U.S. wouldn't have to go in and do that. That would be one way of appeasing in the middle. But again, if you're Denmark right now, you're like, hey, everybody just stay off of my picnic table.
What would you propose the Canadian government do and the people of Canada do to stave off a potential assault by the United States? Is there something we can do in practical terms aside from beefing up our military and asking the Europeans to defend us?
Well, I think the thing is that we should get psychologically prepared for some sort of aggression by the Trump administration. And it might be more tariffs. It might be a show of force. It might be preposterous things said in international circles. But we can expect something more to come down the road from him. The practicality of actually occupying a space, a foreign country, is inherently difficult. And the U.S. does not do a good job of it. They've demonstrated that in how many occasions, dating back to the Korean War, if not even before that. And for a country like Canada to suddenly obey foreign rule and sovereignty would require tremendous amount of buy-in within our own institutions, our own police forces, even our public safety and emergency response services would have to now abide by that new order. And I don't see that happening. I think there is enough vibrant resistance within the Canadian population to not work itself that way. And really, you look at the United States itself, most of the day-to-day business that government is involved in your life takes place at the county level. The federal stuff is mostly wars and diplomacy. The state's very concerned about how you drive a vehicle, maybe some degree of education, but it's the county that does most of the governance for people's daily lives. And so you would need, under a U.S. system, you would need that kind of buy-in, and it just doesn't exist here. So in terms of actually operating something like that, I couldn't see it happening. It wouldn't be feasible. It'd be too expensive. And I don't think morally Americans would be able to digest the thought of military aggression on Canadian neighbors. But at the same time, we should get ready for more hostility, more economic tensions, and probably gearing ourselves up in a way where those traditional relationships that were taken for granted between the two countries are going to wind up grinding themselves to a halt.
And then there are those who argue that Canada is already, I don't want to go to an extreme, but it is already effectively annexed. I mean, maybe that's too much to say that Canada has lost that degree of sovereignty. But when you look at the degree of fear that the Canadian leaders, Prime Minister Carney and Prime Minister Starmer in the UK and the French and the Germans,